Hello and welcome to episode 216 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
I'm Tristan Carcino.
And I'm coming to you from Boulevard Park, Washington. I forgot for a second there.
I was going to say, where do Peltoncast. You live? I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of your Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks. You know I be in the town all day.
Well, this pod parks a bit of a change of direction for us as we turn our attention a little bit away from Let's Remember Some Years with sports starting back up. The Seattle sports team actually played a game on Tuesday night for the first time.
Tacoma sports team.
Well, okay, the Puget Sound sports team. Yes, that's fair. So we're going to have a little bit different Let's Remember Some Years this week as we bring on Joseph Evans, his third Pelton brother. But before we get to that, we should start with this week's beer. We have this week, I picked this up at Costco the other day as I was braving the crowds there, from the Silver City Brewery, our friends at the Silver City Brewery in Silverdale, Washington, the Irresistible Bliss Strawberry Vanilla IPA. Like dessert in a pint glass, Irresistible Bliss is a deliciously dense and decadent hazy IPA that incorporates milk sugar for a sweet and fluffy texture, further enhanced by neutral vanilla and strawberry essence.
It smells very sweet.
Natural vanilla. That's not neutral vanilla. Small lettering. All right, let's crack this open.
Pretty good.
I'm still pouring.
It's almost like beer with strawberry quick in it.
Well, that's a fascinating description.
And I mean that in a good way, because strawberry quick slaps.
Recently, our uncle was putting together the last section of our grandma Pelton kept a diary throughout her life. And he's putting together the last section. And for the end, having the grandchildren write up our memories of our grandmother. And one of the things that we talked about when we were like conversing about what we were going to mention was drinking strawberry quick at her house.
Strawberry quick on ice cream.
Yes.
That's the shit right there. if it's 1993.
Wow. That's an interesting, I like that though. All right. A few toasts this week. First off, to third Pelton brother Mina Kimes, who was named today as part of NFL Live's new regular panel starting in August and officially making her an NFL analyst for ESPN. So big congrats to Mina on that move.
Wow. Incredible. Waking up to see this. I feel like there's been like four or five times in the last couple of years that I've woken up, pull up Twitter, naturally, because that's what you do, and I've seen amazing news about Mina.
It's an upward ascent. You asked me if I had seen this, and I was like, have I seen the thing that everyone on Twitter is talking about?
I was more as it introducing a conversation.
All right.
God, I'm just like advanced level conversationalist over here instead of just jumping into it. We're gonna wake up one day. This is a Jermaine Curse level prediction, and we'll be like, oh, Mina's president.
Like, speak that into existence. I don't.
We'll probably find that out the night of.
Yeah, it'd be really weird if we didn't stay up for that news. Okay, next up, to Damian Lillard, who is the first player announced as appearing on the cover of NBA 2K21.
And the timing for that, that's going to be a fascinating situation.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. They're going to have to push that back compared to normal, right?
This is awesome, though. I mean, every time I think about Dame, it really has been interesting during this time period without basketball. One of the things that stood out to me is that I miss watching Damian Lillard play basketball in a way that I don't know if I would have predicted that I would.
That makes sense. He's very fun to watch play.
And he's the best basketball player in my life at the moment. You know, there are obviously other, like, I'll still probably cheer for the Lakers if the Blazers are eliminated from this playoffs, but like, and watching LeBron is thrilling, but I'm not thinking about watching LeBron in the way that I am, like, specifically excited to watch Damian Lillard play basketball.
And we'll talk a bit more about that in a second. Actually, after we'll talk a bit more about that in a while, but it'll be coming.
And then also a toast again to Manuel, who we'll talk a little bit more about later, Breonna Taylor, Elijah McClain, Andres Guardado, and all of the victims of police brutality out there.
Toast to that. Lastly, this week, we are pouring one out for Bumbershoot, the latest event canceled for 2020 in Seattle due to the pandemic. It will be the first time since 1970 that Bumbershoot will not be held.
Oh, and this was a surprising one because I didn't think Bumbershoot was happening either way.
Well, you know.
Well, I mean, maybe there would have been some sort of skeleton Bumbershoot, but as you know, for the last, I want to say, 4 years, maybe five, AG has been running Bumbershoot, the same company that puts on events like Coachella. And this year they announced that they were not going to be participating in the event pre-COVID, just for financial reasons. So it was going to be interesting no matter what, how they pivoted. But of course, festival's not going to be able to happen this year.
Yeah. All right, with that, I think it's time to bring in our guest. So this week we're going to do something a little different for Let's Remember Some Years. We've reached 2016, which is the year the Pelton cast came back for good. And it's also, even though it seems like a lot longer because 2016 and because 2020, it's only 4 years ago. So I'm not sure we really need to remember it, reminisce about it as if it was the 90s. So instead this week, we thought it would be fun to bring on to talk about the experiences of watching the Sonics at Key Arena, the guy who was sitting next to us throughout the time that we had season tickets starting in 95, 96 when the Sonics moved into Key Arena, Joseph Evans. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Before we talk about that, though, I want to talk about something more serious. And, you know, that's in your role as a defense attorney in Pierce County. You were involved in putting together and speaking at a protest last week of the investigation of Manuel Ellis's killing at the hands of the Tacoma Police Department and the way that that investigation has as yet failed to produce any firings or any charges against the officers involved. How did that sort of come together?
Well, in my role as a defense attorney, we come in contact with a lot of different members of, you know, the community. And frankly, we see a lot of different cases involving, you know, claims of police brutality and things like that every day. That's basically our job. And so we were familiar with the fact that Manuel Ellis, a bunch of us defense attorneys, were familiar with the fact that he was killed by the police officers. And, you know, from the start, it was a concerning case for us. But as time went on, and of course, the country started to discuss these things more after George Floyd, we were waiting for more information about it. And so the video came out. Some of the videos came out showing Emmanuel Ellis being restrained, being tased. The facts started to come out about the officers' accounts of what happened, differing greatly from the video. The fact that the officers were put on administrative leave initially and then had already been put back on active duty before the videos came out, before the medical examiner's report came out. A lot of us defense attorneys decided we wanted to get together with the family, with the attorney that's representing Manuel Ellis's family, and have a protest, you know, just like they're having around the country, because frankly, this is a local case that raises a lot of concerns for us about the practices of the Tacoma Police Department. So a few folks from that I'm familiar with from the community that are also lawyers organized it, kind of put it all together, and I agreed to come and speak as well. And yeah, we were at the Tacoma Police Department headquarters and protested, I think it was 2 weeks ago, and we're actually planning to do another protest on July 2nd at 5 o'clock. Because nothing has happened yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess, can you just give us an update? You mentioned that nothing has happened yet, of where that case in particular sits.
Sure. So at this point, first it was being investigated by the Pierce County Sheriff's Department and the Pierce County Prosecutor's Office. The Pierce County Sheriff's Department actually had a conflict of interest in that they had an officer at the scene that hadn't disclosed that, so they shouldn't have been investigating what actually occurred. Once the video came out, they recused themselves from it, and then the Pierce County prosecutors ultimately recused themselves of it. And so the state attorney general is now investigating it. But they have not reached any decisions, and the Tacoma Police Department has the officers on administrative leave at this point. And for those folks that don't know, administrative leave is basically that you're being paid to stay at home, but you are still on staff. You are still a law enforcement officer.
I mean, you mentioned this earlier, but, you know, one of the things that's really striking about this case that Tristan and I were talking about earlier is this happened on March 3rd, and I don't think, you know, any of us in the broader community were really aware of it until the protest started of George Floyd's murder. And you know, that seems to that tragedy seems to have had some tiny benefit in terms of obviously starting this conversation, but specifically shining a light on this case in particular.
Absolutely. You know, you're right. The George Floyd thing, you know, and obviously I look at that as, you know, that was a murder. But when we look at what happened with George Floyd, it sort of galvanized people to start examining what has been going on for quite some time. But the key thing, I think, when we talk about the George Floyd case is there was video. There was video that distinctly shows what actually happened, because that's also a case where the police officers' reports don't match up to what we actually saw with our own eyes. Emmanuel Ellis's case, TPD officers don't wear body cams. And the way they've been able to piece it together is video from citizens that happen to be driving by, from a Ring camera, different things that sort of showed what actually occurred. But every day we have citizens that tell us that they've been abused by police. Now, are all of them telling the truth? Maybe not. But without body cams, without more accountability than we currently have in the system, we really don't know what's going on between law enforcement officers and the general public in these sorts of situations where, you know, a struggle ensues or those sorts of things.
And it's shocking to hear you say that Tacoma Police Department doesn't use body cams. Is there steam for a change there happening right now?
I think there is. I think it's a conversation that the police chief is now ready to have. But, you know, I'll tell you this. The Pierce County Sheriffs aren't currently using them either. There's a lot of law enforcement throughout the country that do not use body cams. You hear different reasons why. Some officers say they want them. Other officers say they don't. There's also discussion about costs. It's hard to pinpoint the exact reasons why, but I think it's something that it's long past time to deal with, because, you know, picture's worth 1,000 words. And why not have these interactions recorded?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that is a panacea, certainly, for police brutality, but it does seem like a positive step. I mean, I think one of the disturbing things about the videos you mentioned that have come out from, you know, the private citizens who filmed this is that it's in so many of these cases, it has become hauntingly familiar that, you know, among his last words, possibly his last words, are Manuel is saying, "I can't breathe."
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that we've seen time and time again is that when these incidents go hands-on, officers sometimes resort to chokeholds. And that's something that brings about a huge risk of death. And that's something that we have to address. I mean, there's a lot of different conversations going on about what sort of things should be done in dealing with policing in this country. And I think it's a very long and complicated question. It's going to require a pretty deep analysis about why contact is made with certain people, what sort of policing things that we're prioritizing. It's a long conversation, but what we do see is that when these things get physical, people wind up dying. And a lot of times we're having to ask ourselves, why did this case ever get physical? You know, George Floyd was about him allegedly passing a fake $20 bill. You know, in New York, we saw it over someone selling Lucy cigarettes. You know, in Louisiana, we saw it over somebody selling CDs. Like, why is law enforcement contacting these individuals for things that, frankly, you know, do we actually care about those minor situations? And that's a bigger conversation, you know, and I think it goes back to something that a lot of folks, if you're interested, can look into, which is called broken windows policing. And it's a concept that came about in the 70s and got real popular in the 80s and 90s in New York City. And I think it has a disproportionate effect on communities of color and of low-income citizens.
Yeah, and that's something you, I assume, are seeing on a regular basis in the cases that you're working.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when I look at my cases, what you find is that a lot of times the contact isn't for someone out there committing a crime that we would expect police to be contacting them for. It's police deciding to contact someone for parking in an area that's not lit and doing something they call a welfare check. Or, you know, kids parking at a makeout point late at night. I mean, these are minor things that law enforcement is making a choice about who they contact and when they contact them. And unfortunately, what we find is that disproportionately, it's people of color that get contacted for these minor things. And so, you know, when the contact happens, inevitably, it escalates into a different situation. And so, you know, we find situations where, you know, a person of color might get stopped and frisked for being somewhere late at night. Well, if you did that in the same upper middle class, affluent area to, you know, a Caucasian young man, you're probably going to find drugs just like you're going to find it on the young man of color. But the difference is the neighborhood and how that policing is going on. And I think that's the bigger question that we're going to have to start to talk about in regards to, you know, systemic racism.
From your view as somebody who's sort of inside of the system, and I think, you know, we all have different perspectives about how to approach this problem. But from you as somebody who's a bit of an insider, like what is your preferred choice of action? You know, is it defunding, or is it aggressive training, or similar to the eight can't wait? I'm curious kind of if you had your ideal situation, what that would look like to fix this problem, or at least to start taking steps there.
Yeah, I mean, so eight can't wait has a lot of interesting ideas in it. I don't know that all of them are necessarily practical, and I don't know that necessarily all of them would achieve the effects that we want. There are some things I would love to see. Defunding police is one of those things that if you really study what they're talking about, it makes sense. But I think that the phrasing isn't necessarily great, because the phrasing is something that it frankly scares people, right? It makes people think that you don't want to have police at all. I don't think that's really the solution. I think the solution is probably starting to look at more of community-based solutions with minor things. So if you have someone that's having a mental health crisis, a mental health counselor should be sent. Maybe the police are there as a backup, but try to resolve that thing peacefully. Try to take an opportunity to see if you can get that person to go to a crisis intervention spot. Try to see if you can de-escalate the situation, get them to a hospital, get them on their meds, things like that. You know, we already talked about body cams. I think that would be very important. I think we also need to start looking at what issues and why police are making contact. You know, we have to examine that bigger question. And even with something as simple as traffic stops, do traffic stops have to have an officer that is armed and is actually investigating other crimes? Or could we create some sort of other traffic, you know, officer that makes contact and is clearly marked as not being an investigatory, you know, officer with a gun, and they issue a ticket and we move on? I mean, these are bigger conversations I think we have to look at as a society.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a lot of the time the way that this kind of encounter ends is kind of defined by the way the attitude that's taken going in. If you go in assuming this is going to be a dangerous encounter, you're going to operate in almost a self-fulfilling manner, as opposed to, you know, if you go in assuming that this is going to be something that, you know, is a problem you're trying to solve rather than trying to deal with an individual that's a problem.
I think you just nailed it, Kevin. I think you just nailed it. I mean, I can give you an example. About a week before the George Floyd situation happened, I decided to take the day off from work. It was like a Friday. And I was driving in my car, you know, it's a Mercedes, whatever, through a neighborhood that's kind of known for being a neighborhood you don't really drive through because the police like to pull folks over. And so I was driving through it for not even 5 minutes. I'll get lit up. You know, I pulled to the side. I've been pulled over before. I've been asked to step out of my car multiple times, never actually been arrested for a crime, but you know, that's what it is. And so I get pulled over and, you know, I immediately, you know, roll down my window, but I have my hands on top of the steering wheel, you know, just waiting for the officer to approach. But the first thing the officer does is tap on my back window and ask me to roll that down. Well, why is he interested in what's in my back seat? But sure, you know, I roll it down. He's looking in there before he even comes and talks to me. He tells me that I was going, I think he said I was going 33 and a 25. But what he was interested in was my license and my registration. So, okay, I get my license and my registration. I give it to him, whatever. He goes back and runs it. Clearly at this point, I know he's looking to see if the car's stolen, right? Comes back, gives me the stuff and tells me that I was going 33 and a 25, slow down, and lets me go on my way. Now, on the one hand, it's great. Hey, I didn't get a ticket. I don't have to go to court and fight the ticket. I'm on my way. But when you look at that situation from sort of a, you know, just a general lens, he clearly wasn't that interested in a speeding ticket. He was clearly a lot more interested in seeing if the car was stolen, what I had in my car, if I had any contraband. It's that sort of stuff that if I was a person that wasn't familiar with dealing with police, if I was a person that was scared of police in that sort of situation, it could have escalated, right? But I know how to handle myself with police, and you know, I'm trying to de-escalate the situation in that sort of spot. So,
which shouldn't be on you as a citizen to try to de-escalate a situation with police.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're right. It shouldn't be. But again, you know, at the end of the day, I want to make it home, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that also speaks to me to the question of, and this is a real tricky one to actually fix, but if you've got rules on the books that you don't enforce, you know, everyone generally accepts that you're going to be able to go a certain amount over the speed limit and you're going to be fine. But that allows discriminatory policing because of the fact that you can enforce that a different way against a person of color than you can against a white person.
Yeah, and you're 100% right. And you know, and this is one of those neighborhoods where everywhere else around it is 35, but you get in this one little area and it's 25. And so, yeah, if you're not paying perfect attention to it, yeah, you know, you're going to get a ticket there. And they're notorious for giving tickets there. But for some reason, I didn't get one. Well, you know, I guess I'm a little, you know, as a defense attorney, I'm probably a little suspicious, but I seriously doubt he even had me on the radar. It was more that it was a young black guy driving a Mercedes in this neighborhood. It might be stolen. And, you know, maybe that's a little bit of a cynical view, but that's what my experience tells me was the most likely scenario.
Absolutely. And can you talk through, just as a personal experience, what it would be like if you get pulled over and are asked to step out of the car, as a white person who, understanding their privilege, has never been asked to do that when I've been pulled over before?
Sure. Let me think back. I think the last time I was asked to get out of a car was probably about 8 years ago. I think I was actually on my way to a Mariners game. I was meeting up with some friends. And I was driving and I got pulled over near Fife, and the officer came up to me, asked me a couple of questions, and then he said, I want you to step out of the car. And, you know, I'm already a lawyer at that point. I know my rights. You know, I'm very familiar with whether or not he had probable cause or anything you know, to justify getting me out of my car. And I asked him, I said, hey, what are you talking about? I gave you my license. I gave you my registration. He was like, no, I want you to step out of the car. And I was, you know, my response was, sir, I know my rights. You don't have probable cause to ask me to step out of the car. His response at that point was, you can either step out of the car now, or I will mace you, drag you out of the car, and you'll spend the weekend in the Fife jail. So, you know, when you're faced with that decision, even though I know I'm in the right, I get out of the car.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in missing the Mariners game. I'm not interested in spending the weekend in jail. I'm not interested in dealing with mace in my eyes. So I got out of the car, and he ran my license and registration and asked me to sit on the back bumper of the car. And then he asked me if I would consent to a search. And I said, no, I didn't have anything in my car. But at that point, it was just like, absolutely not. And so he said, well, he was going to call and get the dogs. You know, I said, sure, okay, go ahead. So he called to get the dogs. the dogs didn't arrive. And it was about 10, 15 minutes, and the dogs hadn't arrived. So at that point, I decided, you know, I'm a lawyer, so I get a little feisty. I said, well, you know, and I used to know the case by heart. I cited to him a case. I said, you know, it's been too long. He's like, what are you talking about? You come some kind of lawyer. I'm like, yeah, I'm a lawyer, and I'm telling you, it's been too long. You cannot have me sitting out here this long. Otherwise, it's going to be a violation of my rights. And, you know, he kind of smarted off at me a little bit, wrote me a ticket, and finally told me I could go on my way. Good news is I never spent any time in handcuffs in that situation. You know, I didn't get beat up. Nothing seriously bad happened, but it was definitely one of those situations where an officer saw a black man. I think I was driving an SUV back then, and decided that he could probably find some other kind of crime I was committing if he dug a little deeper.
So this is almost literally 99 problems.
Yeah, pretty much. Except that I literally had nothing in my car.
And you were some type of lawyer or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think in 99 problems, didn't he have like a trunk full of coke or something?
Yeah. It was definitely.
But yeah. But otherwise, yeah, it was a 99 problem situation. So, yeah. I mean, this is the experience that black Americans have with police that makes them suspicious and makes them, like, in situations like that. I forget the name of the man that ran away in South Carolina. Like, this is the situation that makes black men scared of police, is because these sorts of things can escalate so quickly, and, you know, you weren't supposed to be stopped in the first place.
Yeah. No, I mean, and also hearing the story, you have to think about it, of the situations of somebody who's being pulled over who isn't an attorney and doesn't know their rights. So, you know, you were fortunate in that situation that you didn't spend time in handcuffs, but obviously there's countless more stories of folks that did, or worse.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So I suppose beyond this, kind of what do you see as we sit here at the end of June, heading into July, as the possibility of real systemic change coming out of these protests?
Yeah, I'm encouraged. I have hope that we are going to make some changes this time. It feels different in that most of the other times people have went out and marched, and I think this is probably my third or fourth time I've marched and spoke about police brutality, but it feels like that this is a sustained thing this time. In the past, you know, it would be that people went out and, you know, we, you know, marched, we made some statements, and it felt like it sort of died afterwards. But people actually seem to be fired up about it. And I'm seeing people that I wouldn't expect to be involved, that I wouldn't expect to be speaking out about it, doing that. And that gives me hope that maybe we're ready to turn a corner here.
Yeah, I mean, what would you encourage people to do to make sure that this momentum isn't lost?
You know, I think there's a couple of different things, right? First of all, going to protests is important. I know it takes time out of our days. I know it disrupts things, but it tells elected officials that people are motivated. The second thing is that people need to vote. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you how to vote. I'm not going to tell you who to vote for. I'm just going to tell you to vote. It's a very sad thing when we look at Americans and the number of Americans that vote. And a lot of times, even when people do vote, it's only in the presidential. And they sort of ignore the lower portions of the ticket. That's a problem. You know, yes, presidency matters. Yes, senators matter. Yes, congressmen matter. But your local council member matters just as much. Your local council member is the one that decided not to put body cams in. Your local council member is the one that decided to leave in that police chief that they knew didn't enforce rules against his officers and didn't terminate him when they used chokeholds. These local elections matter, and Americans need to wake up and start voting for real. Because when we don't vote, this is what the results that we get.
Yep. I suppose just to wrap things up on this, because we don't want to force you to talk about unfun things this entire time. Is there any any place we could get back to the 90s Sonics, which is a lot more fun than this? Is there any place that listeners can go to read more about this case or potentially donate to any causes specifically that pertain to Manuel Ellis?
Sure. I know that the family has set up a GoFundMe on GoFundMe for Manuel Ellis. If you want to read about it, there's a couple of great articles in the Tacoma News Tribune. There's also some good articles on the Seattle Times. King 5 has reported on it. The videos are out there and fully available. There's lots that folks can do to sort of educate themselves on this case. And as I mentioned before, there's another protest that's going to be going on Thursday, July 2nd, outside of TPD. And if you're interested, come on down. You're all are welcome.
Excellent. Yeah, I hope that the listener in the 253 gets out there.
Yeah.
Okay, so as we talk about the Sonics, as we mentioned previously, we show up as season ticket holders in 1995-96, sitting in the second to the last row of Key Arena in the end zone, section 222. And it's kind of fortuitous that we end up, like, no plan, sitting next to you. And I think we're the same age, right?
Yeah, I think we're the same age, yeah. Yeah, I think we're the exact same age.
And both obviously huge sports fans. Like, it turned out to be this great mutual thing for the next several years there, where we'd spend these games obviously cheering on the Sonics, but especially if they got lopsided, talking about pretty much everything else in addition to that.
Yeah, no, we had some good times. We had some great times watching, you know, Gary and Sean and the guys. And there were a lot of blowouts back then.
Yep.
Beat them up pretty good. And we'd sit there and we'd talk sports. It was funny, too, because occasionally folks would sit there and just kind of listen to us. And they said it was almost like listening to sports radio. We had some great conversations back in the day.
Well, I remember talking about when PTI started, and it was Kornheiser and Wilbon, that we should do a version of that someday. So really, you should be the co-host of the podcast.
I'm the problem.
Uh-oh. I don't want to put a wedge between the brothers. But no, we definitely did. We're the early version of local Kornheiser and Wilbon. We would chop it up about all those different sports topics. I mean, heck, I remember talking football back when – And people don't realize this, but back when there weren't a lot of Seahawk fans in town, and you were one of them, Kevin, and Tristan, you too. And we would just talk football and basketball and anything and everything in between. Yeah, we had some great conversations. And just for full disclosure for anyone listening, I'm a 49ers fan. I have been a 49ers fan for 30 plus years. And, you know, but back then there was no Seahawks 49ers rivalry. People don't really understand that about Seattle sports. That's new.
I mean, I don't think even really until, you know, this current era, like, I mean, I guess the T.O. Sharpie game is the only notable Seahawks 49ers game I can even remember from the early years in the NFC West.
Yeah, I think you're right. And back then, I think, 95-96, I want to say the Seahawks were still in the AFC West, weren't they?
Yeah, it wasn't until the early 2000s, I think, that shift happened.
Yep. So, I mean, back then, it was not even a thing. Like, you know, Seahawk fans didn't care about Niner fans, and Niner fans weren't really worried about Seahawk fans. I hated the Cowboys. But yeah, we used to sit there and talk a lot of sports and watch those alley-oops between Gary and Sean. And man, those were some good times. The George Karl era, you know, the unfortunate Vin Baker era. Ugh, I had such high hopes for that guy.
What games kind of stand out when you think back on that era?
Well, obviously the finals, right? Playing Jordan, you know, even then we knew he was the GOAT. And, you know, just watching the competitive fire going on. And, you know, when the Sonics sort of turned it on in that game four, and finally started to figure out, you know, how they could play against that team. That's one of those games that really sticks out in my memory. Let's see. Probably, you know, that series against Utah before that. On the way to the finals. That was a pretty wild series. I'm trying to think back.
I remember the Utah Game 7 when they win in the dramatic Game 7, and then we all just sort of sat there in our seats, where it's almost like stunned for a little bit, and you're like, wait, we're going to the finals. Like, we just need to experience this moment a little bit longer than the game time.
Absolutely. And, you know, I remember, and I don't, you guys weren't season ticket holders yet, but I was there in 93-94 for the Denver series. And that series just traumatized me. I'll never forget watching Mutombo roll on that ground with the ball. And I mean, that was just a horrible, horrible shell shock. Because as a Sonics fan, and I was little, granted I was little, but I just knew we were going to the finals that year. Jordan was gone. It was wide open, you know, and ultimately Houston wins the championship, and we had beat Houston four times that year. We had their number. So, yeah, you're right. That's one of those games that stands out. You know, there were so many good memories and so many wild games. I remember, you guys will probably remember this, every time Charles Barkley used to come to town, he was with Houston at that point, and we would be chanting, Chuck sucks. And just trying to get under his skin. And Barkley always had this ability to kind of get into it with fans in a fun way that made the game so enjoyable.
Tristan, didn't you have some story about, like, saying something to Barkley from the back in the Coliseum days? Am I remembering
to
that
Barkley? No, Vernon Maxwell and Sam Cassell. I don't think I ever had a run-in with Barkley. I was probably too scared of him.
I mean... Run-in is strong here, but...
Run-in?
I mean, the funny thing about us chanting, like, we were so far away. Obviously, no one could hear anything we were saying, even in an arena as small as Key Arena.
Yeah.
But a lot of Brian Russell calling him... calling him Byron Russell, I should
Byron
say.
Russell.
Chanting that, yeah.
We used to heckle the hell out of him. Oh, and then the counting with Malone the free throws. Because it would take so long shooting them. I remember that.
Game one of that Houston series in the second round of the finals year, when we crushed Houston in game one, won by like 40 points. And they gave out, like, there's like booklets or something that we were twirling around, or maybe it was towels. They gave out towels in game one. And you and me had moved to the seats behind us because they were open to have more room. And these dudes came and sat in our seats, and me as a, I guess I was 10 at the time, I was 9 or 10, hit one of the dudes with my towel, and they were like yelling at me, and I'm obviously a child, and then you were there as a little bit older, but also pretty giant, and like talking shit to them and being like, these are our seats and we can get you kicked out. It was like one of the greatest moments of my childhood.
Oh, yeah, the early lawyer in me coming out. I remember that. Yeah. If I remember right, and correct me if I was wrong, we were sitting there. You're right. We had towels. And for some reason, I think maybe the game had turned into a blowout or something. And so we just kind of spread out for fun. And I want to say, I don't know where our parents were right then, but they weren't there. Because I would always come with my mom, and you would come with your mom or sometimes your dad. And you're right. Those guys had sat in our seats, and they wanted to talk shit. And you know, we just had to tell them, excuse my language. You guys, we'll get you kicked out. And I think I even threatened to go get the usher or something, because I felt like we knew the ushers back then, because we used to run around in there so much.
And they were, I mean, that was not a very big section because, you know, it was obviously much deeper on the sidelines, but the end zone, I think we were in the second to last row, but it was like row 12 or row 13. So there weren't that many people in there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you know, here's the thing. It was, those were not, obviously not the best seats in the house, but there was something magical about the Key Arena where you always felt like you were right there. It just isn't that big of an arena. So even being up towards the top, you still had that feeling and the magic of what was going on in the game. And you certainly saw everything really clearly. I think, I mean, in some ways, it was better for X's and O's.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Especially seeing the alley-oop develop. You'd see Kemp at mid-court, and he just turns on the afterburners, and GP's still in the backcourt, but you know the lob is going up. And that's to me, the most magical moment in all of sports. Maybe it's either that or when Russell Wilson drops back and he throws a deep ball and the camera pans, and you just know that it's going to be on target because he's such a good deep passer.
There's this receiver that you don't see, but he's going to be there.
You just know it. The two most magical moments in sports for me.
Oh, no, hey, listen, even as a Niner fan, I can appreciate when Russell Wilson drops back and throws that deep ball. I mean, listen, that guy can play ball. And you're right, that Sean and Gary connection was just something beautiful. I think I was on Instagram the other day, and Gary was posting about how wonderful it was to play with a guy like Sean, and you could just toss the ball up, and he knew he'd go get it. And that was the beauty of it. You could just see the play developing. You could also see, like, when Sam Perkins would be leaking to the top and that kick out was going to come and he hit that three. Oh, good times. And there was really nothing like spring basketball.
Yeah, when the weather starts getting nice, I still love that, going down to Portland for playoff games there. I mean, there's so many little things. We could do a podcast for hours, like the call of three-pointers, the and the Campbell sound effect, the good after that, like just so many little things about the experience of going to a Sonics game.
Well, and then remember that video they started showing, I think it was in 95-96 with Sean Kemp, and he was going to raise the roof, but they played in the fourth quarter. Oh, man.
And then eventually they'd play it, and it was the, we talked about this earlier, didn't we? The P. Diddy and Jimmy Page.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
They play that and it goes into Come With Me. And and you're just like, so hyped. Yeah, we had theories about it where it was like, if they play the Kemp one, you're going to win. And if they play the Payton one, you're going to lose. This is no offense to Gary Payton. We just crunched the numbers or whatever and felt like the Kemp one got us more hyped.
Yeah, it was that fourth quarter thing. And let's face it, I think I was like 12, 13. You were 10. Of course, Kevin was 12 or 13. Like, it was one of those things where you were superstitious as could be, but man, those were good times. I stopped having my season tickets back in 02, 03. I was in my first year of law school. I was way too busy. My mom was way too busy, and we were just not making it to the games enough to justify having season tickets anymore. So we let ours go. And I would still get ticket packages. In fact, I think I used to come see you on Press Row, Kevin, when I was in when I would be there.
Right.
Because I think by that time you were starting to do stuff for the Sonics and the Storm. Yep. But I always planned on getting season tickets again, you know, once I was done with law school, settled down, had some money in my pocket again. And then the summer of 07. So still bitter about that.
We managed to end this on a down note again somehow.
Yeah. Well, I just want to say that I feel like we really, you know, you get to know the people who are around you really well at basketball more than any other sport, basically. You know, like baseball, you don't have the same sort of season ticket culture. Football was only 10 games at the most, really. And you don't get to know the people around you like you do at a basketball game. Also, it's a little bit quieter. There's a lot more downtime. The people who are around you matter a lot at a basketball game. And to be able to have season tickets and sit next to people you can have great conversations with, and you know you'll see them 40 times a year, is really an incredible thing. So I feel like in the 90s, not only were we lucky to have that basketball team, but also to have that experience 40 times a year.
You know, I totally agree with you, man. The reality is, I looked forward to being able to hang out with you guys at those games. I mean, yeah, watching basketball with my mom was fun. We had a good time. But being able to sit there with somebody your own age and yep. experience it, sort of process what was going on, be interested in the same things, it was definitely a great experience. Hell, I even remember towards the end, you know, well, not the end, but, you know, 14, 15, and you start getting a little bit older, you start noticing those cheerleaders. That Sonics dance team, boy, that was something when you were 14 or 15.
Definitely so.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, hopefully soon, sooner rather than later, we'll get a team back. You get your season tickets, and I'll come visit you instead of you having to come visit me on Press Row.
Sounds good to me, man. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, thanks so much for doing this. I mean, it was really a great conversation. Very enlightening.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Talk to you guys soon. Take care.
Well, that was a great conversation. Again, thanks so much to Joseph for joining us.
Incredible. I that was up there with one of the best conversations we've ever had in the Pelton cast. For a second, I was proud to do this podcast.
That is a new emotion. Well, I'm proud to bring back something we have not done since March, and it's not actually related to sports. It is time once again for us to search for Seattle's best teriyaki, because last Friday,
wow,
we did the pop-up from Addo Seattle with them doing chicken teriyaki.
There we go.
I drove up there to Ballard, drove it back to my house where you picked it up. And what did you think?
It was a unique teriyaki. What I will say is that Addo is not a teriyaki restaurant. And
it is not.
These pop-ups that Eric Rivera has been doing, every single one has been very good, but also it seems like they're trying things out that they're just interested in doing that week. And it's not like, you know, they haven't been cooking chicken teriyaki for 10 years, like some of the other teriyaki restaurants that we've been to. This is like, well, I'm just going to cook that and then we'll sell it, in the same way that this week we're getting eggplant and chicken parmesan, you know, and the previous week we got cheesesteaks. Like, these are just foods that Eric Rivera seems to want to do. And for that, I sincerely applaud him. And I also think, as something for that they have not been specializing in for a decade, it was an incredible chicken teriyaki.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was a specific interest of his. This I had actually learned that they were I had a conversation with a friend who writes about food. We met up for brunch back in Portland in like February, I think right after the All-Star break. And he mentioned that this was something that Eric Rivera was planning, that he had seen on Instagram. And so, you know, I was looking forward
to pop-ups or chicken teriyaki?
Chicken teriyaki specifically.
Interesting.
And this, I think at that point, was going to be in like March or April in the restaurant before, you know, the pandemic hit and they moved to this takeout model. So it's definitely something that has been, you know, anticipated for a long period of time. And I would say that, yeah, if we're rating on my scale, if we bring back my scale that I was using.
Wow. Nature is healing.
It is. Chicken is a full 10 here. Like, it was such high quality chicken compared to
a full 10. It's a very different chicken. The Addo pop-up takeout chicken. It's real chicken. Like, this is not thinly sliced chicken that you're used to getting at a teriyaki restaurant. This is like a cooked chicken breast with teriyaki sauce on it, which it's very different. I mean, it's thick slabs of chicken.
Right.
Perfectly moist and juicy, like exactly what you would want from chicken with teriyaki sauce on it.
I think the sauce was good, but not necessarily outstanding, would be my assessment.
It was a light sauce. Not that there wasn't enough of it, but just it wasn't overly sweet and overly glazy, I would say. It hinted a little bit more toward the vinegar side than the sweet side of teriyaki sauce. And I think that's the place that ultimately, I don't want to say that they lost me, but, like, you know, the teriyaki sauce is the most important part of a chicken teriyaki. I think you can have substandard chicken and still have a very good chicken teriyaki, and this was it was a sauce that it just didn't quite get there. You were very close, but it needed to be just like 10% sweeter, and I think it would have been perfect then.
The one thing I liked is that there was some sauce on the rice. So, like, there wasn't, it wasn't like eating straight white rice without putting anything on it. That I liked.
Sauce proportions were, I think, perfect.
I mean, I don't want to say this lost me, because, again, this was great. Would definitely eat it again. If you're going to say, like, where this, why this isn't Seattle's best chicken teriyaki, despite being, in some ways, Seattle's best chicken teriyaki, it's just the teriyaki atmosphere isn't there. Like, it's not from a teriyaki restaurant.
Yep.
I need some gyoza.
It needs to be, to get past the sort of, like, neighborhood teriyaki joint, it had to be so much markedly better. And I don't think that was the case with this teriyaki. The chicken possibly was, but the overall package wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like when we talked about going to June Baby and the next week I was just like, I need that again. You know, if they had chicken teriyaki on the menu this week at Addo, I probably wouldn't go back. So I think that that's the biggest part of it, is I would still probably prefer to drive, no matter how much you hate it, to my neighborhood teriyaki place than travel to Ballard for teriyaki.
I mean, that's the other thing is, yes, one of the things we started this search back in, like, February, I think we started this, maybe January, was the question of, is there any teriyaki worth traveling for? Because that is a pretty high bar when it comes to teriyaki.
And I don't think this, it doesn't, it by no means blows neighborhood teriyaki out of the water, and I think I still probably would prefer, God, I wish I've forgotten some of the names of teriyaki places we've been to. It's been so long. The one that was on First Hill by
Yoshino.
Yeah, I think the Yoshino teriyaki to me is the leader by a pretty considerable amount, and the only one where I feel
considerable
like
considerable amount. Wow.
It was the only one where I'm like, when I think about it, I'm like, fuck, maybe I should go tomorrow to get some Yoshino teriyaki.
You didn't feel as positive as I did about Ichiro teriyaki in Wedgwood? Or, I'm sorry, Magnolia Village, I should say?
Not at all. I thought it was replacement-level teriyaki.
So are we going to continue this search now that we're traveling all over the city to pick up food?
Sure, fuck it.
All right, here's where I'm going to tell you we need to go next week, because I've already been there way back in late February, I think.
This is not... You're going to review something from February?
I mean, I can go back. I'm just saying I've been there and we haven't talked about it in the pod yet, because I was trying to get one in before my trip to Sloan that, as it turned out, was the end of us reviewing... was the start of you staying at home. So Teriyaki Madness, which is also on Capitol Hill.
All right, we'll see what happens. No, I can get to Capitol Hill.
Okay. We can commit to that for next week as we resume this search?
Absolutely we can.
All right. It feels like the Pelton cast is back now.
Wow, this is huge.
Okay, it is time for our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci Pizza is coming back, and so are we.
No, Pagliacci's not coming back. Been here the whole time. There may have been some sort of bubble reference. I don't know. The NBA's seeding game schedule is out, and it is not favorable for the Blazers. Ooh. By my estimates, they've got the fifth hardest schedule of the teams in Orlando or heading to Orlando, while the New Orleans Pelicans, currently tied with them in terms of games back, percentage points behind in the standings, so the Blazers will advance over them if they have the same record. But the Pelicans have the easiest schedule, which does make sense because they had the easiest remaining schedule of any team.
This is Adam Silver pulling some David Stern bullshit here. We know who they want in these playoffs, and it's not the Blazers.
I mean, they do want the Pelicans, but this is the one thing is, I screwed up the schedule, like, several of us had looked when there was a first discussion about just taking the next eight games on team schedule and using that. Several of us had looked and said, okay, well, you can do that, but then you have to add these three makeup games to the end of the schedule, two of which would have included the Blazers against either the Lakers and either Orlando or Miami. But it turned out there actually was a way that you could have kept all the games that were currently on the schedule, and that's what the NBA ended up doing.
How can they do that?
Well, not like all the games that are on the schedule, but every game that is going to be played in Orlando is a game that previously was scheduled in the remainder of the season.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's interesting.
It is. So it's hard to say they were you know, playing too much favorites based on that. So you add in the Trevor Ariza.
He released the schedule with a frozen envelope. Let's just say that. We know what happened.
You add in the absence of Trevor Ariza, who we talked about last week, because of the visitation window with his son, and I now estimate about an 11% chance of the Blazers reaching the play-in tournament. So definitely an uphill battle for them.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. All right. The biggest news of the past week. I've been waiting to podcast about this. I've been eager to podcast about this. Amazon has won naming rights for the new Seattle Arena in place of Key Arena to now be named Climate Pledge Arena in reference to Amazon's pledge to reach zero carbon emissions by 2040. Really rolls off the tongue.
It's the CPA. What are the nicknames people are going for here?
I think Greenhouse is the best. I like that, especially like if and when the Sonics are returning, so you have a team wearing green in there, because it doesn't seem like the NHL team will be. It seems like they're probably going to be wearing red.
It's cool. Another win. Thanks.
The arena aims to earn zero carbon certification from the International Living Future Institute, which would be a first for an entertainment or sports venue. The plan is to eliminate single-use plastic by 2024, eliminating non-recyclable or compostable waste. The venue will be powered by solar energy from on-site panels and off-site farms. And the Oakview Group, NHL Seattle, also plan to purchase carbon offsets to match estimated emissions from travel to and from the arena.
There we go. I don't want to fault them for having this climate pledge. What is the financial backing of this climate pledge from Amazon?
What do you like the actual pledge?
Yeah. What is the pledge?
The pledge is that they are trying to get to zero carbon emissions by 2040, which would be 10 years ahead of kind of the deadline that has been set internationally so far.
Are they contributing financially to climate change causes?
I am not sure about the specifics of that. That was not in my research. I mean, it seems like the carbon emissions are up lately for Amazon. So, you know, Amazon, 2020, January 2020, Amazon announces $2 billion climate pledge fund to invest in companies building products, services, and technologies to decarbonize the economy and protect the planet. This is actually from a week ago, just before the arena was announced.
There we go. Well, Amazon really felt like they had something in common with the Oakview Group here, because the Oakview Group also doesn't want to pay taxes.
Well, that is the Paris Agreement, by the way, that sets that 2050 deadline for companies to be net zero carbon.
Mark your calendars.
So, I mean, look.
We're going to be taking the light rail around by the time that there's no carbon emissions.
God willing, there's going to be a new West Seattle bridge. We'll be taking the light rail to West Seattle. It'll be
utopia. Just got over coronavirus.
Yeah. There'll be teriyaki on every corner. I mean, the name itself is lame. The pledge is not that binding of a thing, as it turns out. But
binding.
No. But the fact that, like, the arena is going to be so eco-friendly is probably good news, I think, from all of this.
Okay, so one important thing that came out of this was, I guess two important things, the climate pledge and the low carbon footprint of the arena, is still ultimately positive news. Another positive, though, was the commitment to having local businesses running concessions throughout the arena. Did you see this?
I think that's something they had already talked about during the application process. So it was something we were aware of is a likely possibility.
And would be, I would say, commensurate with the other arenas throughout the Seattle area. It seems like over time we've seen CenturyLink and we've seen Safeco Field get so much more local. And this is a national trend.
Yep.
But I think we can at the very least expect to have good food in this arena.
I mean, I think if you're talking about, like, from the fan experience standpoint, what's going to be an upgrade about Climate Pledge Arena, now that we can call it that, instead of New Arena at Seattle Center or the renovated Key Arena or whatever we were calling it awkwardly beforehand, the food options are at the very top of the list of things that are likely to be better about the fan experience at Climate Pledge Arena.
Yes, versus Key Arena.
Which was, like, you're starting, there was, I guess, some local. There was Kid Valley and Ivers, I think, were in there for a period of time. But the vast majority of it was, like, the generic Aramark concessions.
I mean, the arena wasn't in use, really, after the culture had changed.
I mean, I was still going there on a regular basis, good sir.
But for a lot less events. I think if the Sonics were still playing in Key Arena 41 games, I think we could have seen a change. But also, you know, the reason that the team moved was because it was a relic of the past.
Yep.
And if they had built a new arena in, whatever, 2010 or something like that, it would have looked very different than Key Arena. So it was a 90s arena, and the concessions were 90s concessions.
Oh, they sure were. They may actually have literally been left over from the 90s. I can't rule that out.
Oh, come on.
What?
But also, at that same time, over the last couple of years, we've seen both Safeco and CenturyLink move heavily toward local businesses.
This is also something that some people, I can't think of who this might be, who are nostalgic for the Kingdom, overlook about it as compared to T-Mobile Park and CenturyLink. Have you been calling it Safeco this entire time?
Whatever. I'll continue.
I mean, one thing that I will say very positively.
You can't compare these. This is a bullshit comparison. You can't compare these apples to apples and be like, this thing in the 90s didn't have as good food as this thing had in, like, 2017 on. The entire time that it was Safeco Field for a long time before they had good food.
I mean, they had garlic fries at least.
Garlic fries ain't Din Tai Fung.
I agree. I'm not disputing that. I'm just saying it's also not the King Dog.
They would have. Let's say that apples to apples, the King Dome is still there.
They would have garlic
fries and Din Tai Fung in the King Dome. The building itself doesn't determine what the concessions are. The building doesn't care what the concessions are. It's now, the time period that cares about the concessions.
That's a fun fact, because I happen to know that you know that is untrue, because we have posed this very question to Robbie Tonkin about why they are not in certain locations. And he has pointed out that it's because of the fact that those locations do not necessarily have the appropriate amenities to create the Taco Time Northwest experience. You just got lawyered.
No, not true.
You did. The kingdom
could have had an appropriate amenities. It was literally size. That was it. They had too small of a space at CenturyLink Field. They could have been in a bigger stall somewhere else. I didn't get lawyered. Are you kidding me? It was just that they happened to, at CenturyLink Field, have a smaller stall available for concessions to Taco Time than some of the other ones there.
I was referring to Husky Stadium, and I think that it's likely that the concession...
That shit was renovated in the mid-2000s.
Sure, it wasn't as renovated as Climate Pledge Arena. I'm still getting used to it. Climate Pledge Arena is. I think that when they built stadiums prior to the 2000s, they weren't thinking as much about the amenities needed for local restaurants to be in there, because that wasn't something they were trying to do. So the thing I was going to say as a positive about Key Arena is it was, like, a good corporate name for an arena, because it didn't sound very corporate, especially just calling it the Key. So we'll see where Climate Pledge Arena. I think that's going to be on the other side of that scale in all likelihood.
Uh-huh.
Not a lot happening on the Mariners front this week. I assume no hot takes.
No. I think I might have delivered my hot takes about the food.
Oh yeah, that was a pretty hot take. Minor League Baseball officially announced that they are canceling the 2020 season. No surprise there.
No, I thought that already happened. I saw that as news today, but I thought that was already announced.
It was just assumed.
Okay.
But now it's official. On the Sounders front, the group stage schedule for the MLS Bat is Back tournament has been announced. The Sounders will play on July 10th. That's Friday night versus the San Jose Earthquakes.
Wow, that's
7:30 Pacific time. On Wednesday, July 15th at 6 a.m., they got the coveted 6 a.m. Pacific slot against FC Dallas.
They are playing a match at 7:30 p.m. Pacific and then a match at 6 a.m. Pacific?
I believe we talked about this. As usual, you don't pay attention during the Sounders segment. They are not playing during the hot midday hours in Orlando, so therefore it's very early starts, 9 a.m., or very late starts. I think there is an earlier, it's probably like a 5 p.m. window, but then the Pacific window, but then the 7:30 p.m. Pacific, which would be 10:30 p.m. Eastern time. And this, as we've discussed, is part of the World Cup feel of this tournament.
Oh, I mean, these are all must-watch matches in a way that almost no Sounders non-playoff match has been.
I got to be honest, I'm not setting my alarm for 6 a.m. for FC Dallas.
Bring it on, whatever day July 15th is.
And then Monday, July 20th versus the Vancouver Whitecaps, that one will be a 7:30 p.m. Pacific start.
What? This tournament is actually called the MLS's Back tournament?
It sure is.
Who named this?
Who are the ad wizards behind this one?
It really sounds like it's like a Backstreet Boys reunion tour.
I mean, Backstreet's back, all right. I mean, that was just right there. That was sitting there. Yeah, it's not the most creative name I've ever seen. I would actually welcome Climate Pledge Tournament. Sounders forward Will Bruin, who was working his way back from the ACL tear that sidelined him midway through 2019. Now, TBD to play in tournament after suffering a tibia injury in a scrimmage at Starfire in Tukwila. He was given a 4 to 6 week timeline as of last Wednesday, which would at the earliest put him back for the knockout rounds of the MLS's Back tournament if the Sounders advance.
The Will Bruin is Back tournament.
Yeah. The Sounders signed a third player to a homegrown player contract on Tuesday after adding to the roster two of them a few weeks ago. This is midfielder Shandon Hopiao, who has more USL experience than the other two additions at age 21 and has seen action for the first team in two US Open Cup matches in one MLS match. So wouldn't be surprised to see him as a sub available in this tournament.
So he was playing for the Defiance, or?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, he came from Sounders Academy, played for the Defiance, and now completing that process of joining the first team.
His lifelong dream of playing in the MLS's Back tournament.
Look, take what we can get right now. As I mentioned earlier, we had a Seattle area, a Puget Sound sporting event on Tuesday night. OL Reign opening their NWSL Challenge Cup schedule with a thrilling 0-0 draw against Sky Blue FC.
Reminding us of why we waited so long for live sports.
You know, I mean, I wouldn't say this was just a soccer match. It wasn't like notably sloppy. It wasn't like evident that neither of these two teams had played any competitive sort of thing besides a scrimmage this season. But there was some good goalkeeping, and the teams were unable to convert the opportunities they did have in this one.
And so this match happened on something called CBS All Access.
Yes, all matches in the NWSL Challenge Cup, the NWSL is Back tournament, other than the opening match and then the final of the tournament, will be on CBS All Access. That's CBS's over-the-top streaming service, I guess is the word I'm looking for here.
Over-the-top? Is that an official term?
Yeah.
Is that a Sly Stallone reference?
It's not. It's sadly no. I wish it were. Would that it were. But like ESPN Plus, Disney Plus, these are considered over the top services because they're above and beyond what you're offering just with your cable package.
But this is
the actual televised.
Did you subscribe to this already, or did you get it for these? matches.
No, I, what am I watching on CBS? Like, they had a thing where it was like, pick your three favorite CBS shows before you start, and one of them was the NWSL Challenge Cup, and I eventually settled on, they have Cheers on this, apparently, and I put The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, which I have never watched in my life.
Look, my third choice. I know you've seen a Big Bang Theory before.
That is accurate. I'm not actually sure Big Bang Theory is on there yet, but it probably is.
I don't mean to out you here, but I at one point you have said that you were a fan of Big Bang Theory, I think.
I don't know. Fan is, yes, I guess that's probably fair.
I've seen zero episodes, so.
So it is a 1 week free trial and then $5.99 a month thereafter. So, I mean, I wish I probably could have given that directly to the NWSL, but, you know, I certainly think that's subscribing and watching these matches probably, you know, helps their standing in the eyes of CBS, their new broadcast partner.
And this is a long-term deal that they have with CBS?
I'm not sure the length of it.
But do we think this is kind of bullshit that these matches aren't on TV in any way? When there's literally nothing else happening, we constantly hear about how live sports are the most important thing to television providers, and we can't even get professional sports on the TV.
I mean, certainly that would be great. I mean, I don't know that that option was sitting there for them. They did, you know, like I said, getting on the main network CBS for those two matches is a big deal, I think, for the NWSL. And then from CBS's standpoint, they certainly want to use this to sell their All Access.
Right.
So OL Reign with 1 point coming out of this match, tied for third place. There were two teams that won their opening match outright, the Washington Pride and the North Carolina Courage. And then two teams that lost, obviously, those two matches, the Chicago Red Stars and the rival Portland Thorns.
Ugh.
And then the other four teams involved in draws so far. So the teams will play four matches apiece in the NWSL Challenge Cup. The OL Reign up next on Saturday on the 4th of July versus the Houston Dash at 7 p.m. Before taking the pitch, notably, OL Reign posted a powerful video on their social media today showing the impact of systemic racism on their roster by asking players 10 questions related to their background and experience and asking players with more favorable outcomes to step forward after each question. And you should definitely check out the video that's linked in the post notes. I also retweeted it from the PeltonCast account, but suffice it to say that it's a visual reminder that the results are what you would expect them to be. On the Seattle Storm front, big news on Monday as we learned that Coach Dan Hughes won't travel with the team to Bradenton, Florida for the 2020 WNBA season at the IMG Academy. Coach Hughes is age 65 and coming off last year's battle with cancer. It was determined by his doctors and the WNBA's medical personnel that Coach Hughes is at a higher risk of severe illness from COVID-19. And so, therefore, was unable to participate. Gary Kloppenberg was named by the Storm their head coach for the 2020 season, acting head coach, with assistant Noel Quinn as associate head coach, and Ryan Webb, who's been part of the coaching staff for several seasons, rounding out the coaching staff in Florida, is the second assistant. This is a similar setup to what the Storm saw at the start of the 2019 season, when Hughes missed the first 9 games for the Storm following surgery to remove a carcinoid tumor from his digestive tract.
And so Kloppy was running the team then as well.
Right, and he's also coached, spent 2 years as head coach in the WNBA for the Tulsa Shock. So, you know, this is not an unfamiliar role for him. I'm sure Coach, you know, that Dan Hughes will be very involved from afar, you know, watching the games, providing feedback, you know, probably even potentially even having the chance, I think, to speak one-on-one to players, you know, via technology, which has been what they've been using to communicate so far, but still not the same as being there in person.
You make Zoom or FaceTime sound like it. Via technology.
Well, I'm saying that, like, last year, I don't think he was probably doing that when he was, you know, away from the team. Obviously, he was also recovering from this surgery, and his doctors wanted to make sure he did, you know, took it slowly. That's not the same kind of limitations on his ability to work now. It's just he can't do it in Florida.
Yeah.
So
no, I think it makes sense ultimately to focus on his health here if there are capable people who can run the team for the year.
So all indications, we haven't heard a final roster yet for the Storm or any sort of announcement like that, but haven't heard any indications that anyone is not planning to play for the Storm. Sue Bird was on the ESPN Daily podcast with Mina Kimes, who is giving that up as part of her promotion. Pablo Torre will be taking that on earlier this week and said that she is planning to play. Brianna Stewart's been back working out. All indications are she's planning to play coming off her Achilles injury. So it seems like the Storm should have a full roster, and you know that's not going to be true of a lot of the other contenders. We talked last week about the players on Washington, Atlanta, Connecticut that have decided to sit out. And then we learned last week after we recorded that podcast that the LA Sparks are going to be without two of their key players, newly acquired guard Christy Tolliver, who had been with the Champion Mystics, and then Shinea Gwumike. So definitely a number of teams not going to have full-strength rosters like the Storm apparently will.
So things looking good for the Storm heading into this tournament, having Subert back for the first time in a year.
Yeah, my ESPN colleague Michelle Vopel put together power rankings to start the season on Tuesday, and the Storm were number one.
Wow.
They also will have, we know, their 2019 first-round pick, Ezzy Megbegor, who stayed in Australia last year because the roster was full. And she wanted to continue her development. There was reporting in Australia that she got on a plane on Sunday, headed, or on Monday, I guess, in Australia. It was Sunday here, headed to Seattle and will travel with the team to Florida.
All right. What is the television situation going to be like for these games?
You know, we haven't seen a schedule yet, but we'll presumably be a lot of – I don't know if there will be local TV. I don't know what the plans are, but – you know, definitely the WNBA Live Access, and a lot of them then will be on ESPN family of networks.
Okay.
Because that'll be the typical number of games you'd see over the full season, but they're only playing 22 games instead of the usual 34. UW Athletics announced financial cutbacks last Friday, including voluntary salary reduction of a minimum of 5% for head coaches, a minimum of 3% for assistant coaches and contract staff, and furloughs of 2 to 4 weeks for professional, classified, and union staff members. Additionally, athletic director Jen Cohen and football and men's basketball coaches Jimmy Lake and Mike Hopkins agreed to waive all performance-related incentives in the upcoming academic year and make gifts to the athletic department. Specifically, Lake and Hopkins are giving $100,000 each to fund the creation of a senior-level diversity and inclusion staff position to be hired later this summer as an associate athletic director.
And those furloughed employees will stand in solidarity, of course, with all of UW athletes by not getting paid.
Well, look, that's a larger issue that you know, is ongoing through the pandemic, certainly.
I'm assuming that the university will, of course, pay them in education.
Some positive news on the UW football front. UW football set a team record, broke a record recently set with a 3.29 GPA in the spring quarter. So, you know, academics continuing to be a major focus. Even with Jimmy Lake replacing Chris Peterson, no surprise there. And even with the, you know, unusual setup of remote learning for the spring quarter.
That's a good GPA.
It's a very good GPA. Yeah, and some of the position groups were even higher. Like, I think I saw defensive backs were like 3.53 average.
There we go.
Yeah.
DBU.
Yeah. All right, not a lot on the Seahawks, but Josina Anderson offered an update on Tuesday on Jadeveon Clowney's free agency, which really was about what we thought. Clowney said he plans to sign, quote, before the season starts, if everything still goes on time with the season, and also said, quote, no, I have not narrowed down a final team. I'm still open.
Yeah, he would have signed if he'd narrowed down a final team.
Well, he could have ruled some teams out without signing.
Are we going to talk about Cam Newton signing with the Patriots?
We should talk about that. It's thrilling news for you because you'd much rather have Cam Newton on the other side in week two when the Patriots are scheduled to come to,
to
Seattle
God.
For Sunday Night Football rather than ruining the locker room. I mean,
I think you're always mischaracterizing exactly what I said, but okay.
That's verbatim what I remember.
Ruining the locker room.
Dividing the locker room. Is that better? obviously, in hindsight, that discussion was not necessary because it turned out there was a starting job out there for him in all likelihood. I mean, you know, I don't know if the Patriots are going to hand it to him, but you obviously feel a lot better about his chances of beating Jarrett Stidham out than Russell Wilson.
Yeah, I'm expecting Cam Newton to be starting that game. Man, I did not even think about that they're playing the Seahawks in Week 2 on Sunday Night Football. That is going to be fun.
It is going to be fun.
If it happens.
Yeah, I mean, that's all the question about all of this.
This is just sometimes the right thing happens.
Well, and, I don't know if I would say that this is, I mean, is it the logical thing? I don't know if I would say it's the right thing.
Like, I'm shocked that it took this long, I guess is what I'll say, that if you're Cam Newton, you want to play at the place that doesn't really have a starting quarterback and is going into this year with a quarterback who has not played a game and is losing a Hall of Fame quarterback. Like, this is the right situation. This is a job that he can win. And I don't look at it as like, well, the Patriots like snuck one past everybody again. This move was out there, you know? And anybody could have done it, yeah. And maybe it'll work out. Even if it does work out, I'm sure that I'll be frustrated because it's the Patriots. But at the same time, I think I'll just applaud Cam Newton on having a good job.
I mean, I hope he does well there. Not in Week 2, but otherwise. Hey, I mean, it's not like the Patriots are in the NFC.
Yeah, this is not, like, I think there are a lot of people who had, like, weird animosity about this. And it's just like, what are you upset about? You either want Cam Newton to be your starting quarterback or you don't, because he's going to be a starting quarterback in New England. So what's the issue here? Like, if you're the Seahawks and the job you're offering is, and I ultimately think the reason that they didn't even engage in a conversation with Cam Newton was because they knew that Cam Newton was a starting caliber quarterback.
We don't know that they didn't engage in a conversation with
Cam. We'd heard that the two teams that showed real interest were the Patriots and the Browns.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, they gauged interest at some point, it seems likely, and were politely told, yeah, that's what we're thinking, and I think, you know, everybody just kind of moved on with their lives.
That's it. That is what I was saying to you, though.
You can be... That is not what you were saying to me. You can be upset about the fact that...
Precisely. I was like, good sir, Cam Newton deserves a starting job in the league.
I mean, you did say he's a starter repeatedly over and over again.
Yeah, and now he's a fucking starter.
But you could have hoped is someone who doesn't necessarily root for the success of the Patriots that they would have screwed this up. You certainly could have hoped for
that.
Who
would have screwed this up?
The Patriots.
Honestly, as a fan of the sport, I would hope that Cam Newton has the best possible job.
That's fair. I mean,
it would be shitty of me to be a fan of this sport and the athletes who play it and say Cam Newton should be a backup in Seattle than be a starter in New England.
Well, I mean, I think there could have been a situation where, you know, like the Jameis Winston going to a, what was it? Oh, it's Harvard education with the Saints. Like, there could have been that sort of, I guess, I mean, he doesn't need the education in the same way. Cam Newton's a much more experienced player than Jameis Winston is.
What is Harvard education that the former MVP needs?
I'm not saying it from that standpoint. I'm saying, like, he could have gone somewhere where he could have had a Ryan Tannehill situation, where he wasn't the starter going in, but he ultimately ended up in a better situation.
Ryan Tannehill should not be considered the norm. That is a unique situation.
I agree, but you could have hoped for Cam Newton to have a situation like that and not just be on the Patriots.
I don't know. My hatred for the Patriots does not outweigh my interest in Cam Newton having a good starting job in the NFL.
I mean, definitely, I dislike Cam Newton haters more than I dislike the Patriots.
And honestly, like, if that's how you're approaching things, you just are not a fan of these players who are playing in the league.
I think you're taking this all a little too binary, I guess, is what I would say.
I'm taking a victory lap here.
How is this a victory lap?
It's a victory lap because Cam Newton got the starting job that I said that he would get. Or at least he got a good chance at a starting job that I said I mean, that he would get. And the reason that I didn't want the Seahawks to, in this hypothetical world, to sign Cam Newton was because I felt like he was somebody who both personally felt like a starting caliber quarterback and is a starting caliber quarterback.
But the point you're missing here is there's a key word there, and that's hypothetical. The idea was, in a world where the Patriots aren't interested in him as a starting quarterback, like if your argument had been this debate is irrelevant because Cam Newton's not signing here, like I couldn't argue against that. Like that's true, but we were having a hypothetical conversation, and your hypothetical argument was non-hypothetically bad.
Well, I've changed my hypothetical argument.
Oh, no.
Hypothetically.
I pledge to no longer engage in hypothetical arguments.
It really, at the same time, seeing it, you did have to have a moment of just like, ah, fuck.
Okay, that's all I needed you to admit.
Right? That like, ah. But it's because you know that Cam Newton is a good quarterback. Like, you don't have that conversation. I'm going to argue the exact opposite in 1 second here. Wait for it. It's not because you wish that he would have signed with the Seahawks. It's more because the Patriots, like it feels like they always do, end up with the star level player on the cheap and easy.
Exactly.
If you had seen that Cam Newton had signed with basically any other team where he could have been a starter, if he'd signed with Oakland and been like, oh yeah, I mean, obviously he wouldn't because they've signed Mariota, but like if he had signed with a team where he could have
Washington. If Washington had been like, yeah, we actually think that Dwayne Haskins needs more seasoning. Let's start Cam Newton this year.
Yeah.
Let's reunite him and Ron Rivera.
You wouldn't have had the same response because it doesn't. It's not like that constantly is happening to Washington where they're getting good players for the last decade on the cheap, right? And
correct.
Like I don't have feelings about Washington. I feel nothing about them as a franchise, but I do about the Patriots.
I have some feelings about them as a franchise. They're mostly off the field. They're not on the field.
It's very different than the feelings about the Patriots. But at the same time, like I can look past that because ultimately I'm a fan of the sport in general. And I want the best players.
Well, so are you walking around with an NFL hoodie?
A Rob Lowe NFL hat.
yes. Great reference.
I'm not saying specifically that, but I would always cheer for people to be in the best situation possible. It's the same way that I don't cheer for teams to have players injured when they're playing the Seahawks. You know what I mean? Right. Like, just fucking, let's just play the games on the level. Like, we don't need to have any sort of, like, chicanery here. Let's just see what happens.
I don't know that in this case it's the Seahawks that are the ones having the chicanery. Patriots simultaneously, of course, forfeiting a 2021 third-round pick for their taping.
Cam Newton didn't make that happen.
I'm not blaming Cam for that. I'm just telling you that happened simultaneously.
The other point is that I think Cam Newton is probably a starting caliber NFL quarterback, but like I don't look at it and say, like now the Patriots are a Super Bowl contender because they signed Cam Newton. Right? Like, we've seen Ben Baldwin post about his efficiency. We had this argument about how good he was same podcast.
You really did come back around the other side. Wow. Through the rabbit hole.
But it's a continuum. Like, the Patriots probably weren't a Super Bowl caliber team last year. I think he's probably about the same level, if not better, than Tom Brady. But, like,
if healthy, yeah.
Statistically, were the Patriots one of the top five teams last year?
Their defense was really good. I think you might be underselling their defense.
I mean, yes, their defense is good. But, like, it's not one of those things where you're just like, it's not the 2007 Patriots. Like, you didn't just give one of the best offenses in the world Randy Moss.
That is true.
So, I think that's the other side of this. Where it's not like
the Patriots were second in DVOA last year.
Fuck me. They really were.
They were ahead of the Chiefs. Obviously, Patrick Mahomes was injured during the regular season.
That's wild.
Yeah. They did go 12-4. They get a bye. Or they didn't get a bye. They very nobly didn't get a bye.
They did not get a bye.
They could have gotten a bye. Let's go with that.
Well, they'll probably win the Super Bowl with Cam Newton. Whatever. Who cares?
All right.
I'd rather them win a Super Bowl with Cam Newton than him be a backup in Seattle.
I would still rather him be a backup in Seattle.
That's really kind of offensive when you think about it, but okay.
You know. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.